You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
So, John, we're getting the big leagues now. We are heirs. We're going to finally be on the map.
Yeah, like, we got people listening. We got people coming in wanting to talk to us.
I mean, one of those people in particular, he's an actor, voice actor, writer, director. It's Mr. Christopher Randolph. Of course, probably best known to our audience as the voice of Otacon, Hal Emmerich and Huey Emmerich. Happy to have you on, sir.
I'm so happy to be here. It's great.
Yeah.
Really great.
How has did you experience Austin traffic today?
Yes, we did. We did. A little bit. There's some construction going on.
Yeah, it's always a nightmare.
Yeah, I feel like there's always construction going on.
Yeah. It's a beautiful day, though. It's like really the rain yesterday really cleared things out. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's the first time where the weather in Austin is actually really nice and not super hot or humid.
Right.
Which is...
It's that nice mix.
Yeah, right. Finally.
That spring right. mix.
Yeah, but next week it'll be like 100 degrees or something like that, which it usually is. But what brings you down here to Texas?
Well, I came down... I've been down here the past week or so doing a play with a company called New York Shakespeare Exchange. So we had a full production of the play Much Ado About Nothing that we ran in New York City the last month or so. And then we made arrangements to come down to actually not quite Austin, but College Station, Bryan, where Texas A&M is.
Mm-hmm.
And we, yeah, I know. I realize I'm in UT country now,
yes.
So I have to be careful. We did a couple of performances of Much Ado About Nothing, and then the other thing we did was we did some teaching in the high schools and also at Texas A&M, and we do this really cool thing called the Shakespeare Pub Crawl.
I like the sound of that.
Where, yeah, no, it's really fun. You buy a ticket and you show up at a bar on a Saturday afternoon, and they give you a whole bunch of drink tickets. And while you're at that first bar having your first beer, a Shakespearean scene will break out all around you, mm-hmm. on the tables, on the bar, in amongst you.
Oh, my God.
And you enjoy your drink and you enjoy the scene. And then the scene ends and you finish your drink and you walk down the street to the next bar. And you use your drink tickets there to get another drink. And another scene will break out. And when we do it in New York, we go to four different bars over the course of an afternoon. Mm-hmm. In Bryan, we went to six different bars because it's Texas and everything's bigger in Texas. And it was a huge success. We sold out. We had about 200 people.
Wow.
And in fact, we had to crisscross audiences from bar to bar because some of the bars were smaller. And then the final scene was this huge bar, so all 200 people came together for the final scene.
Whoa.
Wow.
It was really, really fun.
That actually sounds like the best way to drink. Because we have these things here in Austin. It's like you ride a bike while you're drinking. And you're like,
really?
You're chugging together. And that does not sound
no
like it mixes.
Way. No, it
but
certainly doesn't.
I have
doesn't.
A bunch of theater friends and just... That description sounds right up their alley.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun. And it was a huge success in Bryan. And we were all talking. This company, New York Shakespeare Exchange, wants to do this kind of thing regularly. Their sort of mission statement is to bring Shakespeare to people who don't usually get Shakespeare, mm-hmm. in a way that people who think that they don't like Shakespeare or understand Shakespeare can really get.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was part of a larger project they're calling Intersections, to bring out to different communities than New York to stimulate conversation about the world and about literature and Shakespeare. So anyway, I think the plan is next year to maybe go back to Bryan, but also to go other places. So I think they're going to try and look into coming to Austin, which I think would be great. Maybe a couple of other cities in Texas. And they were worried about the pub crawl, thinking that, you know, to do a pub crawl in Austin, going to bars on a Saturday afternoon, they might be so crowded already that, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There's multiple streets in the city that, like, you could probably plan that at. So, like, there's a big enough... And the east side's getting bigger. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's entirely doable. They just need to get some organization to it.
No, definitely. So. That sounds great. I mean, yeah. you should do it on 6th Street.
Yes,
definitely,
sure.
Definitely
I mean, that would be really awesome. And I know that the actors would love that, mm-hmm. you know. Because Bryan was great, but there's not a whole lot going on, you know. And,
yeah.
And Austin is Austin. I mean...
It's where it's happening.
Absolutely where it's happening. So,
yeah. Well, Well, if we just want to kind of get into it, what originally made you want to pursue acting?
You know, it started really early in grade school. A really astute and wonderful English teacher, who also was the head of the drama program at my grade school, I don't know how she got it, but she kind of picked me out. She said, "Hey, I have a part for you." I think this was fifth grade or something. And I did it, and I got really hooked on it almost immediately. So all throughout school, I was doing plays. Right. And then I got to high school and did a lot of theater there. And by then, I had pretty much decided I wanted to do it. I didn't get a degree in it in undergraduate college. Mm-hmm. I just got a degree in English, which at the time was very frustrating, but more recently I found actually to be enormously valuable. But then I went to graduate school in San Diego and got an MFA in acting.
Wow.
And entered the profession.
Okay. Oh, John, do you have a question?
Yeah, well, starting from fifth grade and, you know, up until like 2 days ago when you were performing, and Ryan, I assume you've learned so many different things. What kind of challenges have you faced as an actor, you know, during all those experiences?
Well, that's a great question. I think that the biggest challenge for actors is learning what to do when you're not working, is because a lot of your time is spent trying to find work. You know, I think most people think of actors as, you know, the folks you see on TV and in the movies. And if you go to a theater or something, you see them there, or, you know, Broadway. Those actors are extraordinary and extraordinarily lucky. The majority of actors, you spend a lot of time trying to find work. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest lesson for me has been to, like, branch out, find ways to generate your own work, or start doing other things. The last 5 years or so, I've been directing theater a lot, which has been wonderful. You start writing your own stuff, and you begin to find other avenues, such as voice acting, which, frankly, when I was coming out of graduate school, didn't really exist unless you were going to do a cartoon.
Sure.
You know? And now, of course, it's a whole other branch of the industry.
Yeah.
And a huge thing. And it's not just games. There's cartoons and movies and all sorts of stuff like that. Yeah. And, of course, commercials.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's a huge industry just
for
that.
Yeah.
Is there a particular moment that you're especially proud of on, like, your stage career?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's funny because I've played small roles in really big shows. Mm-hmm. So I had a very small part in a production of King Lear that starred Christopher Plummer.
Cool.
Right, awesome. And that was on Broadway.
Wow.
So that was a very, very exciting thing to do. But then there's the other way where you're in slightly smaller theaters and you have a more challenging role. So I think I did a Pinter play at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, and it was the play Betrayal. And that there was something about that particular project that just really came together really well, you know. And I was very proud of that work. I think most actors will say you never know when you're starting out how it's going to turn out, mm-hmm. you know. You look at movies sometimes and you see really great actors in a movie that's not so good. And you go, why did they choose to do that?
Yeah.
And the point is they didn't know. You know, it looked good on paper. Mm-hmm. It was a great group of people set up. So you go, yes. And then, you know, it doesn't work out so well. So you sort of stumble on to your successes in a way, I mm-hmm. think. I'm really proud of the work in the Metal Gear series. All of it. Because it was, when I first started, it was new territory and none of us really mm-hmm. knew what it was going to be like or anything. And then it came out and it became this big thing. And I played the first game and was like, wow, this is really great.
Mm-hmm.
But again, when you're doing it, you're so isolated from what it's going to be in the end that you have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, just off the top of my head, I remember playing the original Metal Gear Solid for the PS1.
Right.
And I thought, this was so different from any video game that I had played.
Absolutely.
Because it was, even though it was having fun and it was goofy, it was taking itself seriously. And it told like a really compelling spy story. With
right.
all these other crazy stuff in between. And
right.
That, I really, it showed me that video games could have a strong narrative.
Yes.
When going forward.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's... I think that's what Kojima really accomplished, you know, back in, when was it, 99 or something?
98,
whenever that game came out.
Yeah.
You know, and I have always felt that his goal is to sort of bring the idea of a movie and a game as close as possible mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
And he really pushed the envelope on that. And he continues, or, you know, he continued even with MGS5 was... You know,
yeah, it was magnum opus in a way.
Yes, you know? I think so.
No, and obviously, no your work in that was particularly incredible,
thank
as
you,
I could
yeah,
call it, as Huey,
yes,
the father,
right?
Of him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, you did mention you were teaching some classes, and you mentioned some of the struggles. I was just wondering what kind of advice do you give to your students, or even other potential actors when they find themselves in a lull or they see those struggles? What has kept you going on, like? Dealing with maybe the stumbling through the career.
Right. Well, that's a great question. I mean, there's a couple of things. One is what I kind of said already, which is, you know, particularly now, and we were talking about this earlier, in the internet age, it's so easy to create your own work. And I had a wonderful teacher when I was in Los Angeles, because you never stop going to classes, mm-hmm. you know, even when you're in the profession. I had a great teacher who always... was trying to get us to think of ourselves not just as actors, but as storytellers. And there are all these different ways to tell a story, right? So you can tell a story as an actor, where you're sort of telling the story of an individual human being from the inside out in the larger structure of a larger story. You can tell a story by writing a script where you're telling a story. You're telling a story when you're directing, you're sort of clarifying and making a story, giving a story the most impact that it can. You're obviously, when you're making a movie, you're telling a story. So if you think of yourself like that, it opens up all sorts of worlds to you. And you can explore those. So I try and pass that on. And then the other thing I think is that, and actors far wiser than I have said this, that, you know, the great thing about being an actor is that everything in your life is usable, is a tool. So go live.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you can, go to, you know, go off to Thailand, or, you know, go out, go, you know, hitchhike around the country, or,
yeah.
you know, whatever. Have some life experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more of that you have, the deeper and richer your work is going to be when you
yeah.
do come back to it again. So.
The reason why we're laughing is just because,
yeah.
John.
I was in Thailand last week.
Oh, were you really?
Yes. Last week?
Yeah, my girlfriend's studying abroad.
No way.
Doing some marketing stuff, so I thought that was interesting. Are there places like... Sorry to step on.
No, go ahead. Go for
but
it.
I just want to know, like, you mentioned traveling abroad and stuff like that. What is there a certain experience that really stuck out to you that helped you kind of shape who you are?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, a bunch of things. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I went to Japan for a summer on a grant and studied with a theater company. And,
oh, cool.
And that was really interesting. And but the theater work was interesting, but also just being in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Was fascinating. That was back in the 80s. And Japan was different than it is now, even. You know, I went to Egypt one time, and I got desperately ill. And, you know, and you sort of at the time, you think, oh, God, this is horrible. I wish I'd never done this. And then you come back, and you recover, and you go, wow, that was amazing.
Yeah.
I really got a lot out of that. So, yeah, I mean... Anything can be, you know, just living in New York City. I mean, you just walking around, watching people, seeing people on the subway, you know, it's all informative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In many ways.
There's an energy in New York City that you just kind of feed off of.
Absolutely.
The time I was there.
So. Yeah. No, it's really true. And it's, I think, I feel like, it feels like it's always been that way and mm-hmm. it always will be that
yeah.
way. So it's a very, I find it a very exciting place to live. Very exciting.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to ask was kind of like the differences and like kind of the challenges when you know, comparing acting to voice acting. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that stands out in particular to you that
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, the obvious is that your body doesn't matter, which actually increasingly is not true as they do more and more facial capture, you know. So for MGS5, we had to do a bunch of facial capture sessions where they put the dots all over your face. And so then your facial movements are important. But the thing about voice acting is that it doesn't matter how you look. So, but you have to put an enormous amount of energy into it. So you find yourself behind the microphone here, you know, just... You know, making faces and moving your body around and just to get the full effect of what you're doing. So that's fascinating and was a really good lesson for me to learn. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it's really just acting. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's really just acting.
Yeah.
And certainly with the Metal Gear series... You know, these are characters, and they have obviously huge backstories and things they want and need and people they love and people they hate. And so you just, it's the same thing. You're putting yourself inside of that person, whoever
that's great.
Be.
Yeah.
Kind of speaking, continuing on that, I know that Kojima and his crew have, when they create these games, they have these massive ideas and a direction that they definitely want to go in.
Right.
And thinking about when you work on the stage, you kind of have to react to the crowd's energy and spontaneity, and maybe something might go wrong and you have to learn how to react. Right. Is there any sort of spontaneity that you're allowed to, you know, introduce when you're doing your voice work?
You know, yes, to a degree there is. The good thing is that you can always do another take. Mm-hmm. So you certainly have to do the words that are there, but you can try all sorts of different ways to go about it. And there have been times when when you do it in sections. Mm-hmm. So, and there have been times when I will do a take a certain way, and Chris Zimmerman, our amazing voice director, will go, "That's really great. I hadn't heard it that way. Try it this way for me now, because we've got that one already." So your spontaneity and your approach to what the character is thinking and being can be alive like that. And that's I think that's the challenge, really, mm-hmm. to not just be reading words off a page, you know.
To add your personality.
Yes, exactly. Yes, definitely.
I mean, what was kind of the origins of your voice work? How was it introduced to you?
I was in an acting class. I was living in Los Angeles in the 90s, and I was in an acting class, terrific acting class, with Jennifer Hale.
Yes. I'm a big fan.
Who's wonderful, yeah. No, Jennifer's awesome. And we were chatting after class, and she was talking about an animation voice class that she had taken. And she was just starting her voice career. She had become... She was the voice of Dell for a while. She said, you know, this class is really fun. You should really try. And so I did. I signed up for it. And it was taught by two people. One, an amazing voice actor named Charlie Adler, who does a lot of cartoons and like trippy cartoons. I mean, have you ever seen like Cow and Chicken?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Charlie is Cow and Chicken and the Devil. He's all three of the lead characters, right?
Yeah.
So he's crazy nuts and a wonderful teacher. So I learned the first half was taught by him. Mm-hmm. And then the second half was taught by Chris Zimmerman, who was a voice actor and became a voice director and casting director. And so, as I say, I got an enormous amount out of the class. And then a while later, I have to go look at my calendar to find out. I mean, it was easily 8 months to a year later, I got a call from Chris saying, "Hey, you know, I'm casting this weird game thing, and none of us really know what it's going to be, but I've gotten a lot of good people to come in, and would you like to come in and audition?" Yeah, absolutely. So I went in and auditioned, and they initially had me reading for Snake. I've told this story before, but they had me reading for Snake.
Yeah.
And I When you audition, they give you a picture of the character and just a few lines. Mm-hmm. And you go into the recording booth and they, you know, you'll do a few passes right. of what you think the voice might sound like. Mm-hmm. So I did my probably lame attempt at Snake. And they said, thanks. And I was getting ready to leave. And then they said, hold on. So I could see through the window there was this conference going on mm-hmm. with Chris and some Japanese people. And then she came into the booth and handed me another piece of paper and another piece of copy saying, will you read for this? And there was this picture of Otacon mm-hmm. at the time. And he had long hair, yep. but he was wearing his glasses. And these are my glasses, you know. So the long face and the long hair. And I looked down and I went, man, that looks a little bit like me.
Yeah.
What is that about? So I read some Otacon.
Yeah.
And then I got the job.
Yeah. Obviously, yeah. I was going to say, I mean, you from playing Metal Gear Solid 5, I mean, you look like Huey. I mean, it's definitely there. There are those.
Sure. Yeah. No. And I think I have no idea how deliberate that is. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the looks of the characters have changed sure. from game to game. But I feel like they've gotten more detailed and sort of almost, there's almost more character,
yeah.
certainly for Snake, but in the way the faces are. And then because we did facial capture for 5, they sort of have to use at least my bone structure mm-hmm. and then they can put whatever they want on top of that. So, yeah, I mean, I always wonder if they, like, am I the character? Is the character me?
Yeah.
Is it?
Oh, that's cool.
I would assume that they have to take that they do end up taking some sort of who you are and taking little bits and pieces. Just hearing how you were saying you were interacting with Chris Zimmerman,
right.
You do something one way, and he's like, "Huh, that gives me an idea. Let's try it this way." And I can, yes. I bet someone like Kojima would also take that into account as he's developing the characters.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so. It's funny because it's hard to know where you know. How much influence Kojima has on that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the characters were his idea and the grand structure of the games are his. And he's got a huge team that works on it. But yes, I mean, I think he couldn't help but be influenced by
yeah.
all of our work in one way or another. You know, certainly David Hayter.
Yeah.
You know.
What was kind of your first initial reaction to playing Hal Otacon,
yes.
and then Huey later on in the series?
Right. Well, it was really fun because it was, you know, Hal was great and mm-hmm. is great, and I have deep affection for that character, and I hope I get to play it again sometime.
Yeah.
It was really interesting to kind of try to reverse engineer a character based on the character's son, you know. So we kind of had to think about, you know, and also based on the little bit at the time, anyway, that we knew about him. Obviously, we've learned a lot more
sure.
now. But that was interesting. And I worked with Chris about, you know, how's the voice different? And what is it that, you know, just really, yeah, how is the voice different?
Mm-hmm.
Where is he coming from? He's coming from a different place. And what kind of person is he? And in, I think the first time we did it was Peace Walker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peace Walker.
And he was, it's interesting because I haven't gone back to Peace Walker in a long time. But, you know, there are clips on the internet and occasionally I stumble on them mm-hmm. and give them a listen. And in Peace Walker, he was as much a narrator as anything else. I mean, there was a lot of sort of explaining circumstances in
sure.
Peace Walker, and you got to know him a little bit. But then when we got to Metal Gear 5, you know, you began to really learn about him.
Yeah, I guess my reaction to Hal always comes across as a flawed but a very good man.
Yes.
Where Huey, he's a little morally gray, and he's
yes.
made some bad decisions that have led to some bad things.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting to play a character like that mm-hmm. because, you know, you can go back and forth about is he good or is he bad, or, you know, and what's going on and what did he really do and what did he not really do? Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, you know, you do these games in bits and pieces over sometimes a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I was never really sure if he was good or bad, mm-hmm. which I think is great. I mean, I think that's the way to approach a character no matter what, is nobody thinks that they're bad.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. true. Yeah.
You know, nobody, even like serial killers, like they have reasons yeah. for doing what they're doing. And so you really can't approach playing a character from the point of view with that kind of judgment mm-hmm. on it. And I think that's one of the things that made it so good in Metal Gear 5 is there's this ambivalence.
Yeah.
You know, is he good? Is he not good? You know.
It sounds like, is there a preference between the two characters? That Huey seems to give you more versatility in what you think you can do and cannot do.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, I think I kind of love them both, but I think that obviously, Otacon has the deeper place in my heart, and I also think that Otacon can go onward. You know, I think mm-hmm. I think the Huey story I think is a closed loop mm-hmm. at this point. You know, whereas Otacon, I think, I mean, geez, you could build a whole game around Otacon. Please build a whole yeah. game. but I mean, I just think there's a lot going on there. And so his life is open in a kind of cool way.
Is there a particular moment that just stands out to you through Hal's journey throughout the entire games, and then also Huey as well?
Sure. You know, the I think the two that really come to me are actually, you know, because he's got a lot of heart, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I always go back to the Sniper Wolf death,
yeah.
which I think is a great scene and
yeah.
is still one of my favorite scenes. And then the other is Emma's death, you know. And those scenes were really telling about how deeply he felt mm-hmm. as a human being, and how, I don't know, they said a lot about his loneliness and isolation, and in a way, it kind of brings him closer to Snake in an odd sure. way. They, you know, over the course of the series, I think he and Snake have really become family almost. Mm-hmm. And given how messed up Otacon's family is, yeah. if you look at his real family,
sure.
You know, he needs that. And so those moments are pretty powerful. And then I suppose, you know, the end of 4, where we're not sure what Snake has done, and mm-hmm. you know, that it's miraculous to me that what Kojima and the team did in terms of, and you sort of pointed it out too, that just, there's a whole world there. There's a story. You're not just playing a game. You it makes you feel
yeah.
in the way that reading a good book does, or seeing a good TV show, or watching a great movie. And in the case of the games, you're involved because you're making active
yeah.
choices, and you start to care. And I think that that's amazing, you know. And I think that's our job as the actors, is to make you care. Because otherwise, it's just, you know, it's just like Pac-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
My brother and I were watching Pixels last night.
Oh,
really stupid
I'm sorry.
Movie.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite funny. But, you know, there's that moment where the supposed inventor of Pac-Man, you know, sort
yeah.
of goes, my son, you know.
That's a good moment.
You know, I think that's the modern gaming era, which kind of started with Metal Gear 1, I think.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah,
is about getting you emotionally involved. You're not just blasting space aliens.
Exactly.
You know?
I'm just thinking, like, those scenes in particular, like with Sniper Wolf and then Emma, that was Jennifer Hale voiced that character,
yes,
right?
It was.
Did you do that together? Because I know that most voice acting, it's just you in a booth and maybe some people on the other side.
That's right. Almost always I've been alone, but I have been in the booth with Jennifer. Okay. And in all honesty, I don't remember if we did that scene together, but we probably did. Mm-hmm. I think I've been in the booth most with David Hayter. Mm-hmm. I was never in the booth with Kiefer, but that's
right.
No surprise. I didn't expect to be. And then Tasia, I think Tasia Valenza played Sniper Wolf.
Yes.
And we were there for that. We were all there. But that was a different recording thing, because that was the first one. Mm-hmm. Where we were all in this kind of dilapidated studio, and so we all had to kind of be crammed into the same space.
But that did that make it like more interesting for you? The fact that you're all together for that?
Yeah, in a good way. I mean, you know, not the whole cast wasn't
sure,
there,
but
you know, you'd get two or three people there. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that was, and this has been told before, but there was no partition between the technicians and the performers. Mm-hmm. So they were all in the same room. So during a take, they could barely breathe. They had to be so quiet. Mm-hmm. Because we were all there. Mm-hmm. You know. Usually you're alone. You know, or you're alone, and sometimes the voices you're acting with have been recorded already, so sometimes they'll play them back, so you're acting to that.
Right.
But sometimes not. Sometimes it's just Chris Zimmerman reading the cues for you.
And do they... Is that a decision based on, I guess, the intensity of the scene? So, like, if it is a death scene, they try and have you... you're more likely to be with someone, or is it just kind of space you're working in?
I would love to think that was, but I have a feeling it's just scheduling more often than not. I mean, I know... You know, again, and Chris Zimmerman is a brilliant voice director, and I know that she knows actors, and I know that she knows that, in fact, your performance is going to be better if the other actor is right there with you and you're playing off of each other in the moment. And so I'm sure that she tries to arrange that for intense scenes like that, but I really think it really just comes down to scheduling, timing, budget, all of that kind of stuff, you know.
What was the kind of thing that just made you want to continue playing this character for all these years, coming back to the Metal Gear series?
You know, why not? I mean, you know, there was no reason why not. And you know, I was talking earlier about being an actor, and you have a lot of downtime. And when something comes along, there's all, you know, you really have to think of a good reason to not do it. It's really fun. It's fun work. And I really grew to really love the characters and the work. And I live in New York City now, and most of the game work is done out in Los Angeles. I would love to do more in other games. And I occasionally something comes through New York, and I do a little bit. I've got a couple voices in Mafia 3. You know, that just came out,
and,
you know, things like that. And I've done a little bit of mocap work. But, you know, it's just fun work. Mm-hmm. It's fun work, and I enjoy it.
You talked about your hoping that Otacon could potentially do more in the future or have a spinoff, something like that. Is there a particular element of that character, you know, going through the series and potentially onward, that you would love to explore or flesh out on, either in Hal or Huey?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I haven't really thought about that. I think with Huey, as I say, I think Huey's kind of, that story is pretty closed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could explore the sort of mid part of his life and just see where he...
kind of the turns that he
and what made him be sort of so morally ambivalent. Mm-hmm. That might be interesting. With Otacon, I just think there's so much you can do with him, you know, because he's been this kind of shy, quiet nerd, but he also, there's some moments where he kind of becomes this comic badass in a way. And the humor of him has always been really appealing, and something that I've always enjoyed playing. So, you know, I think you could certainly if he's not the centerpiece of a game, you could throw him into a game and he could be really valuable, I think. Because, you can almost take him anywhere, you know.
Now, you also mentioned just before that, you would be interested in doing more voice work in other, like, video games or animation. Is there anything that you really want to do that stands out, or, like, a couple things?
There's nothing that I can think of immediately. Mm-hmm. I don't really have the kind of voice for an action hero, the Snake kind of voice, which is, that sort of darker, that kind of thing. I think really what interests me most and what I'd love to see more of is kind of these interesting characters in games, I think it enlivens the game. So, you're not just blowing up aliens.
Sure.
The kind of like Mass Effect, some of those games, there's really interesting stuff. And I think as game designers get continually more and more inventive, mm-hmm. There are ways to do things that are cool and say things about the world and all of that. So it would be really fun to be a part of. I'd love to do Mass Effect.
You don't understand how much that just meant to me.
Really?
That's his favorite.
I was going to say, it's like, maybe you want to check out this BioWare game called Mass Effect or any of their RPGs.
It's a great game.
But if you just want, one suggestion, Telltale, all of their games are so narrative driven.
Right.
To hear your voice on one of their projects is awesome.
Sure. Yeah, no. I mean, I'd love to do that kind of thing. And you're right. A narrative driven is a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. Any kind of narrative-driven thing. And I'm also kind of really interested to see where VR goes in the next 5 years. And if somebody can really come up with a game that really utilizes VR, I think that could be just amazing. And I'm sure they're working on it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's going to happen somehow. I think the holodeck is not that far off.
Yeah.
Well,
there is a Star Trek game where you can play in VR.
So right.
Pretty close to that.
Right. No, I know. But, I mean, I think I bet you in, I don't know how long, but you'll be able to go to a place and pay money and walk into a room and play a game in total surrounding. You put on a suit or the goggles or whatever, and the whole space will be the game. And I would love to see that.
Same.
Don't you think?
I don't think it's far off at all. You see stuff that Microsoft's working on with like HoloDeck or
HoloLens,
the Oculus and the Vive. It's it's right.
VR.
It's so close.
Right.
And I think that opens up a lot of interesting things for players and voice actors
as well.
Absolutely. Because like you said, with the mocap and, having you actually be there and sort of like a hologram, that opens up a whole wide world of possibilities.
I mean, what it needs that big IP to finally sell to say, this, now we can invest in this to show how successful and interesting it can be.
Absolutely. And I think somebody's going to hit it and that's going to, somebody's going to get it right, really right. And then it'll take off from there. So
probably the person I think who probably could get it right is Kojima.
Well, he could. Like, and, I have no doubt that he's working on it. I mean, he's been trying to get a Metal Gear movie made for years.
Right.
And I know he's still trying. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be cool. It's kind of hard to come up with a movie based on a game that has been really good. Some of them have been really successful. The Lara Croft things and the
monetarily successful.
Yes, monetarily successful. And the Mila Jovovich
Resident Evil.
We don't speak of those.
Yes. No, I know. Well, I get that. Yeah. But they've made money.
No, you're right.
So, but it'd be really cool to have a movie come from a game that's actually really good.
You just need people that care about the property to do it. Yes. And not all these executives, we got to put this in here, but this is interesting, so cut this out.
Right.
And it's
get people that know what
you're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that.
And as a voice actor, say a Metal Gear Solid movie did come to fruition, how would you feel to have someone else take over your role if that were necessary?
Yeah. It's bound to happen. And particularly if they're going to do Otacon, you know, the way most of us envision him, I'm a little old. You know, and that's one of the things about being an actor. You have to acknowledge that at a certain point, you know, like playing Hamlet is really not going to happen for me. You know, that's so you sort of do that. That said, it would be very frustrating. And there's no question that if they're going to get a movie like this made, they're going to pick movie stars to do these things. So then you kind of go, well, okay, who would I pick to play Otacon? You know, what movie star comes to mind? And that's a really interesting question. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that. I'd be actually interested.
Oh, man. Who's the guy that plays Q in the new Bond film?
Yes.
That's actually who I was thinking of. Yeah. I do not know his name.
Yeah.
It's like Ben Wheatley. No, that's it.
It's something like that. Yeah.
I know his name. Do you know his name? He doesn't know his name. I know exactly who you mean, and it'll come to me by the, you know, as soon as you turn off the recording, it'll come to me.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
But he's a good choice.
Thank you.
Know, something like that. That's the kind of person that they'll get. My thought, my hope would be because they play around with time so much, you know, that there might be a sequence where you see old Otacon and old Snake, in which case, I hope they give me a call.
That's very possible.
That'd be really fun.
I mean, you could play like Huey, definitely.
Well, I could certainly play Huey, and if they put Huey in that, you know. But again, I don't know if they would consider that or not. You never know. I mean, it also depends on what happens with my career in the next 4 or 5 years. I just never know. I'm trying to get myself on TV more and in more movies. So,
well, if they're smart, they will cast you. Yeah. So,
thank you. That's very kind of you.
That was definitely something we wanted to know was where do you want to go in the future, whether it be directing, TV, more, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I'd like to do it all. I would like to do more camera work because I enjoy it and it's challenging. And that's where you really get paid. But it's also where you gain some power over the industry and begin to sort of move up the ladder in a way. So I'd enjoy doing that. But that said, I don't want to stop what I'm doing now. I really have found I enjoy directing a lot for theater. And I'm thinking about trying to direct a film, talking with some people about how that might work. Obviously, it would be a no-budget short to begin with and then to move on. There's a lot to learn.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting challenge, and I'd love to try it. So, and the theater is my first love, so I will always want to go back to that occasionally as an actor.
Speaking of the theater and the work you're kind of doing with the Sonnet Project, and I think Sonnet 48 is something
you just recently
did.
Yes.
Do you think that those Shakespeare stories, they have a possibility to be retold in a way in video games, or whether that be VR or something like that?
That's a great idea. Sure. Why not?
Which one do you think would be most adaptable, or what you would like to see the most?
Well, you know, that's also a great question. You know, just off the top of my head, Macbeth would make an amazing video game, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got magic and battles and all sorts of, you know, and
murder.
Really interesting murder everywhere and all sorts of interesting characters. And sure, why not? And Shakespeare's stories are really great to be remade, reinvented in all sorts of ways. You know, they're you know, modern movies that have taken... Actually, the Macbeth was made, I can't remember what it was called, but was turned into a gangster movie, a mafia movie.
Oh, okay.
A while, maybe 10, 15 years ago, and I don't remember. I think Steve Buscemi was in it. No, maybe not. I don't remember who was in it.
And there's been many adaptations.
I know, sure, yeah. And that was that. They didn't even use Shakespeare's language, but the story was very clearly that. And you know, there's a series now of novels they're giving to famous novelists, saying, here, take this Shakespeare play and write a novel based on it. Not necessarily in that time. Mm-hmm. So, and those are starting to come out. Very interesting. So, yeah, Shakespeare would be a great ground plan for a game. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I think that shows the timelessness of a lot of his works.
Absolutely.
I could see Telltale do something like that, too.
Oh, definitely. And I think that really opens it up for you.
Yeah, you have a passion
for it. There you go. Sure, so, why not?
You have one last question?
I have one last question. Yeah. Obviously, we were going through your social medias, you know, trying to get a sense of things about you, but I definitely, right. something that piqued my interest. What do you think makes a wonderful blueberry pie? Because I'm a big apple pie fan.
Oh,
I cook those,
right.
So. I'm peach. So.
Well, I love peach pie.
Right?
It's hard to do, though, because you gotta find good peaches. Mm-hmm. That's hard to do. You know, I have found there's a technique that I got from Cook's Illustrated where here's the thing. I don't use flour as a thickener. I use tapioca, which has no flavor but adds texture and yet doesn't get as sort of gummy as cornstarch will. So if you do that, but then Cook's Illustrated had this thing where you take a green apple and you wring all the moisture out of it and you're just using the apple, textured, shredded apple. That also adds pectin, which thickens it without over-flavoring it. And so you get this very strong hit of blueberry flavor, even though it's thickened up. So, and it's not all gummed up. So there you go. There's my,
that's,
you know,
that's
my
actually
secret.
That was a lot.
And thank you, Cook's Illustrated.
That was so,
you know,
descriptive.
That was like a really, really. I bet you didn't expect to get such
I didn't
a clear
think
it was, answer.
When you mentioned pectin, I was like, oh, he's getting chemical over here.
Well, gotta do it, man. And then it's beyond that, it's all about the crust. But that's a whole.
Other I was thing. Hoping you were just gonna say love.
Love is like, of course,
next definitely love. And then you need a lot of people to eat it.
Yeah.
this was a great end to that. Mr. Randolph, thank you so much for coming
thank
here.
You.
It's really
this
was so awesome.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
I'm so glad. Thank you. Thank you very much. You guys have asked great questions.
Thanks.
It's been fun talking.
I'm glad to hear that.
And my pie game about to step up.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, how can people follow you?
Sure. Yeah, I have a Twitter account. Christoph Ran, at Christoph Ran. Mm-hmm. And I am in the midst of putting together a website. Finally, I haven't done that, and I should have done it a long time ago.
Okay.
But eventually that'll go up, and that would probably, I have saved the name, so ChristopherRandolph.com. But it's not there yet.
Okay.
But as soon as it comes up. But Twitter's the best way, I think. Twitter's the best way. And, follow me.
Well, we'll be sure to put that in the description for the podcast. People can follow
Great.
You. When you
Great.
Get your website up, we'd be happy to promote it.
Absolutely.
You,
and, you know, you mentioned Sonnet 48, but the whole Sonnet project is something that can be easily found on the internet, you know, sonnetproject.com. And they haven't completed all of them, but there are a lot up there. I'm in Sonnet 48, but there's some wonderful actors, some of whom are quite famous, doing these 3 to 4 minute films that are fascinating in New York City, different parts of New York, using Shakespeare's sonnets, mm-hmm. and kind of looking at them with different eyes and what they might mean. And so check that out if you can. Absolutely.
Definitely. We'll promote it for you.
Oh,
that's
great.
What we'll do in the description of our podcast and all of our social media stuff.
Great.
So, John, how can people stay in touch with you?
Oh, I'm at @_JohnRomo. You can follow me on Twitter. I don't tweet about blueberry pie, but apple pie is up there, I'm sure.
I'm sure I'll tweet about peach pie. You can
yes.
follow me at Chris J. Herman. You can also follow We Are Error at We Are Error Cast. And be sure to check out @oneofus.net and all of our great content on the site. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Terrific.